Good evening, this is Mark Lynch and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Richard Hollingham, award-winning science and space journalist, and we're talking about his book, Space Dogs, the story of the celebrated canine cosmonauts. Richard, it's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to talk to you too, Mark.
This is an unusual book because you've written a very serious history of a very specific aspect of the space race, and then it's profusely illustrated with these wild sort of souvenirs and gewgaws that memorialize the space dogs.
I think it's a story that we don't hear so often in the West. Those of a certain age will have heard of Laika, the first space dog, the first dog to go into orbit. But a lot of these stories we just do not hear about, particularly now. And so that's the motivation, really, with the book, is to just, you know, tell this sort of, it's not secret history, it's a sort of hidden history of the Soviet space dogs. And I think it's true even in the Soviet Union, as we went into the 80s and then, you know, it dissolved and became Russia, that people even there forgot the space dogs and these amazing animals.
Did you know that there was a British band from the 1990s called Laika?
I did know that. There's a sort of cult around the idea of space dogs. and you can buy T-shirts now. In fact, I was thinking of getting some T-shirts printed with space dog T-shirts because they are awesome. And we owe so much to these animals.
We really do.
That's what, the narrative in the U.S. was about, you know, you had the chimps that flew before.
Well, wait a minute. We're jumping ahead. I want to set the stage. Yeah. For the tenor and the tone of the space race, in that we're talking about the 1950s between the United States and the Soviet Union, I was alive for that, and it was a weirdly scary time. The Soviet Union's space program really took off. Were they the ones that launched Sputnik?
Yeah. So you had, from the beginning. Essentially, it was a missile race, really.
Right. Right.
But all the space firsts from 1957 until the mid-60s were Soviet space firsts. So you had the first satellite, Sputnik, launched in 1957, first animal in orbit. You had first person, first man in orbit.
And I still remember his name, Yuri Gagarin.
Yuri Gagarin. And then first woman.
That's right, Valentina.
Orbit, Valentina Tereshkova.
Yeah.
Capsule with a three-man crew long before the Apollo spacecraft that the Americans first flew, and then the first spacewalk as well, because we've recently had just the sad death of Alexei Leonov, the first man to walk in space, another Soviet achievement. So from the beginning, I mean, it wasn't a space race, it became a space race, but you know, absolutely, from 1957, certainly I'd say till the mid-60s when NASA had its two-man Gemini program, that the Soviet Union was leading all the way. And at the head of that program was the chief designer, Sergei Korolev, who, it was kind of, I suppose, the Soviet equivalent of Wernher von Braun, the NASA rocket scientist.
An ex-Nazi.
We could have a whole discussion about whether or not he was. Technically was a Nazi.
He was in charge of their missile program, and he was part of that Operation Paperclip where they brought a lot of the German scientists here to America. What I want to ask you is, before Sputnik, and we're going to get into the space dogs, did we even have a space program in the United States?
Well, it wasn't a space program. It was a missile program. It was essentially a nuclear weapons delivery program.
Right, really. Right.
So, the U.S. had the atom bomb first, and then the Soviet Union got the atom bomb, and then you're looking at, deliver them through aircraft, or do you, develop missiles? And so it became this missile program. And that's what Wernher von Braun was working on. He was working on, a missile program to deliver, just as he delivered on the V2 rocket bombs on London and England and France. He was looking at how do you deliver a nuclear weapon via a missile. And that was the motivation of the Soviet Union, absolutely, as well. In Stalinist Soviet Union, you know, how do you deliver efficiently a nuclear weapon? And the key thing is here, actually, and it's almost a technical difference between the two sides, that the warhead for the American missile, the nuclear warhead, is much smaller than the Russian nuclear warhead, which meant the Russians had to build bigger rockets to deliver them. And if you've got bigger rockets, more powerful rockets, you can reach orbit. So it was almost by accident that the Soviet Union developed these incredibly powerful rockets, way more powerful than the United States had.
Now, our stuff came down in the water. Where did the Soviet Union stuff get launched from, and where did it come down when they were setting up?
That's the issue, because you've not got the oceans. You know, the U.S. benefits with the space program of having an ocean either side of it.
Right.
You know, you can come down with the early flights, with the early Mercury flights, they'd come down the Atlantic, and then the later flights would come down in the Pacific. So the Soviet Union had basically landlocked. So, you know, unless you could precisely land in a lake or something, you've got to land on the ground. So this was the issue with the early flights. And, in fact, with Yuri Gagarin's space flight, so they had the capability of reaching orbit and then eventually developed the capability of getting back from orbit, which, of course, Yuri Gagarin did.
Right.
At high altitude with the Soviet system, they would eject the capsule. So Yuri Gagarin ejected at high altitude in a sort of ejector couch, really, rather than an ejector seat, and then parachuted to the ground.
Wow.
And his capsule came down to the ground separately. It was only later, and what happens now with the Soyuz, when you see U.S. astronauts land in it, it has these little retro rockets which fire just before it hits the ground. But, I mean, I speak to astronauts about it, and they say it's like being in a car crash when it hits the ground. Whereas, I mean, a splashdown is, you know, it's relatively painless in comparison. But still, you know, still coming in at speed, hitting of water, and I think if you had hit a high wave, that could be really unpleasant.
Now, what inspired the Soviets to start thinking about sending animals and people into space? You know, we were concentrated on delivering nuclear missiles. They were, but then they took this detour that we weren't working on at all. And I mean, if people are listening, I'm talking from the United States. Why did they suddenly decide to do this? That sort of very interesting program.
Fair. There were dreamers on both sides. You know, Wernher von Braun in the U.S. always wanted to send people. He wanted to send people to the moon and onto Mars eventually. And so for the other side, for the Soviet Union, you had Korolev and other rocket engineers. Yes, they were being paid to essentially deliver nuclear weapons, but they wanted to send people into space. I mean, you could also look at it from a military perspective. Well, there was thoughts, well, if you could have people in space on orbiting space stations, then maybe one of the thoughts at the time was you have orbiting space stations, you have people on them, and you could drop bombs from space.
Right.
I mean, it's a really daft idea. But, you know, there was this thought of also surveillance. You know, today we have spy satellites. You could have people in those space stations. So there was an ambition. But the other thing in the Soviet Union almost had this religion about space, and you see it in a lot of the iconography, this idea of cosmism, of humanity making a better future for itself among the stars, of sort of creating its own heaven in the skies. And that tied in very nicely with the thoughts about how communism worked. So, you know, again, making it better for all was the thinking. So there was almost this this zeal behind it and this philosophy behind it of having people in space and people going into the heavens, which had been around for a long time in the Soviet Union. And I don't think there was a similar thing in the U.S.
No.
There wasn't that motivation. So there were a lot of dreamers and a lot of, you know, the societies that wanted to send people into space. But there was much more, I think, this philosophy in the Soviet Union that people would go up. So the money, essentially, was for a military program. But, you know, all the space people like Korolev and the engineers wanted to send people. And on both sides, they both looked at, you know, early biological experiments of, well, hang on, what would happen if you sent a creature into space? Or if we want to send people into space, are they going to be able to survive?
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Richard Hollingham. He's an award-winning science and space journalist. And we're talking about his book. I love this history. Space Dogs, the story of the celebrated canine cosmonauts. Now, Richard, one of the fascinating things, and I can remember this as a kid thinking about this, the Soviets chose dogs as the first things that they sent up. We chose a chimp. Now, for some reason, as a kid, the chimp seemed like a more sensible idea, I think because it was more human-like. But in fact, dogs were a pretty sensible choice.
Yeah, and the Soviet Union had a long history of using dogs in research. I mean, the primary reason to use dogs is they're amenable, they're trainable, and they love you, whatever you do to them. So if you look after them well, and the Soviet space dogs were looked after very well, you know, you train them to endure G-forces, you train them to be okay in a small capsule, you train them how to feed in that small capsule, they get used to confined spaces, accelerations, all those issues, the noise of launch, all that. They come back, you open the hatch, and they're overjoyed to see you. If you look at the pictures or the movies of Ham, the chimp that the Americans sent up into space, looks absolutely terrified.
Right.
And whereas the space dogs would do it again and again and again, Ham absolutely refused to fly again to get into that back into that capsule. So yes, you could argue, you could there's an intelligence you would have with, you could argue with chimps, so Ham could pull levers, press buttons. That's not going to be the case with the space dogs. But, you know, they could, it's the trainability, I think, and, you know, the fact that they were so, they could be, they were almost part of the team. There's only one case where the Soviets sent a dog into space knowing it wouldn't come back. So, you know, they weren't deliberately, you know, none of these dogs, you could argue the morals of this, but none of the dogs were deliberately sent to their death apart from Laika, the first right. Dog in orbit. So all the other dogs, the intention was they would go up into space, they'd test out how they reacted to G-forces, to weightlessness, to the noise. They'd come back, they'd get all that data, and they'd be able to feed that into the human space program.
Was Ham the only chimp we sent in, the United States sent up into space?
A very good question. I don't know the answer to.
It's the only one that I remember, and I remember his picture was on the cover, I think, of Life magazine.
That's almost certainly, yeah.
You never heard about anything else.
No, there were several, as far as I know. I'm not an expert on the chimps, but you know,
that sounds to me like they didn't survive. Is why you don't hear about them.
Well, you know, you could say the same about the dogs because
Laika was memorialized, like left and right. She became a beloved Soviet figure.
Oh, absolutely! And you know, before Laika, there were many space dog flights. So they'd fly these dogs in the early Soviet rocket, which was essentially very much like the early American rocket because they were both based on the V-2. Werner von Braun's rocket. They'd send them up on these suborbital flights, like a missile. So they'd go up, high altitude, a little bit of weightlessness for seconds or minutes, and then they'd come back into the atmosphere, and then they would eject the capsule, and the capsule would parachute to the ground with the space dogs inside. So Laika, only a month after the first satellite, Sputnik 1, Laika flew on November 1957. And that, you know, they knew that they had no way of getting her back. So it was designed as a Soviet propaganda coup, and there was some resistance within the space force, so within the among the rocket engineers to send a dog to her death, essentially. But you know, you're not going to stand up in the Soviet Union and say that. So they flew Laika. The propaganda at the time, and in fact, this was the propaganda, we thought this probably well into till the collapse of the Soviet Union, that she had went up into orbit, had a pleasant orbital flight, and died peacefully. What we know now is She went up into orbit, probably died within a few minutes of that because the capsule overheated, dangerously overheated. They hadn't got the insulation right. So she had a fairly unpleasant death.
Oh, God.
But they knew she was going to die. And, you know, they were sad about it, you know.
There's an amazing story in your book. And I want to start this from the beginning, the process of the biologists from the Aviation Institute rounding up the dogs. And for some reason, the picture of this in my mind is just weird. It seems cinematic. They're driving around Moscow and other cities in a van looking for stray dogs.
Yeah, I think it was actually a car as well, which makes it even weirder. So a black car.
Just cruising around looking for stray dogs.
Yeah. So all the dogs were strays recruited on the streets of Moscow. So they would they did several of these recruiting exercises. I mean, I use the word recruiting loosely. But they weren't, you know, the dogs that were selected, if you like, were self-selected. So they'd go around, see, there's a lot of stray dogs, even today, in subways in Moscow. And they're generally pretty friendly, and they're looked after by people. People will feed them. So they'd go out in their black car late at night on the streets of Moscow, find a suitable subway, jump out with sausage meat, go down to the subway, and the dogs that came and got the sausage meat, they're the ones they would take.
But they were looking for various, and this is, I found fascinating in your book, they had criteria. One of them is that they had to weigh less than 7 kilos. Why?
It's about size. So they had to be small, depending on the size of the spacecraft. So at various times, they had bigger or smaller dogs. They basically could only be a certain weight because that's what they could launch into space. So they had to be fairly, like you say, that sort of weight, small. The other really, I think, fascinating thing about this, and these were all Mongol dogs from the streets of Moscow, or crossbreed dogs from the streets of Moscow, was they had to have bright patches.
I love
on
this.
Them.
I love this.
So either, you know, white or black, and it was so they could be picked up in the capsule by the film cameras or later the TV cameras, so they could tell which dog was which and how they were moving around. So if you had a black Labrador or something like that, well, A, they wouldn't fit in the capsule, and B, you wouldn't be able to see what they were doing when they were in it.
So there,
whereas with these sort of patchy little dogs from the streets of Moscow, they would be able to see what they were doing.
It's sort of self-selecting for cuteness, by the way. Just those criteria alone means that every dog that they're using is a very cute dog.
They are very cute dogs. They are all small and cute. But they kind of, I suppose, in a way, they self-selected for cuteness because they were the friendly ones. They were the ones that would come up
and they had to be meat. They had to be female. Why?
Well, initially there's a mix of male and female, but if you think about how a male dog urinates and has to cock its leg, that's not going to work in a confined space capsule. So that's why they chose female dogs. They also had, for the later flights, they had a sort of pouch arrangement at the back to get the waste, and they had this food they developed, like a gel they developed, as space dog food, with a little sort of feeding area, sort of troughs they could have, and they could also suck on water as well in the spacecraft.
Now, I think the first two dogs were launched in July 22nd, 1951, in Saigon, meaning gypsy, and Desik, and they became the highest ever living creatures at that time. They were the first living things in space.
Yeah, and on these suborbital flights. And this was, I mean, they didn't make much of this in sort of propaganda terms, as much as I can tell, but there were books translated into English. I've seen, you know, some of these, which talks about these experimental flights with the space dogs. And I think this is a point where, you know, it's a bit unfair on the Americans, because a whole U.S. space program, particularly once it became a civilian space program with the formation of NASA, everything was done in public. So you got the successes and the failures, and there were many, many failures.
Yeah.
Of course, in the Soviet Union, you only got the successes. You only learnt of successful flights. So when you look at the whole story of space dogs, you can't – We don't know exactly, but almost half of the dogs were killed at some point, either on launch or on landing or in space. So, you know, there are. You only ever hear of the successes. So we know of that success. We don't know whether there were any flights before that which weren't successful. One of those dogs, so Desik, the second dog, there later died on a subsequent flight. So, you know, the survival rate was not great for these dogs, but then they came from the streets of Moscow where also the survival rate wasn't great for these dogs.
Now, Belka and Strelka, who were found by Ludmila Radkovich. Who's Ludmila Radkovich?
So she was a biologist for the institute that collected and looked after the space dogs. And, you know, again, I should say there were, you know, multiple accounts of how well these dogs were looked after. But, I mean, they had to be well looked after because they wanted them to cooperate. But, you know, they were taken home at the weekend to meet their families. Some of them retired and lived with the families. The chief designer, Sergei Korolev, would always every day go and visit the kennels and check that their water was the right temperature and they had enough food and they were well looked after. And again, you see pictures of her. She very much looked after these dogs. Belka and Strelka, they became, before Yuri Gagarin, they were the big Soviet heroes of the space program.
They did.
Laika. And you look at, with Laika, you had this sort of, you know, very noble souvenirs produced. And, you know, that's what we've got in the book, these very noble souvenirs of Laika, the space dog, sort of, you know, looking noble, looking like she's doing, you know, sacrificed for the greater good. Whereas Belka and Strelka, they became the first dogs to successfully fly in orbit, but crucially return to Earth.
And survived,
yeah. So 18 orbits of the Earth.
Wow.
Launched in August 1960, 18 orbits of the Earth. And then when they seemed to be, you know, there was a video link, and they were watching them. They didn't seem very happy to start with, but then they sort of cheered up, barked, ate a bit, drank a bit, and then returned to Earth. They undid the capsule, and they, you know, they pretty much bounced out. And then, this is the extraordinary bit.
This piece of history, I think I know what you're going to be talking about. I had no idea this happened.
So they become celebrities. They are massive celebrities across the Soviet Union.
There's a great photo of them posing with Van Cliburn, the very famous pianist.
Yeah, they go on chat shows, you know. They go on these American chat, you know, your U.S. late night chat shows. They were the Soviet equivalent of those. On the chat shows, there were postcards, there were cigarettes, there were clocks, there were all sorts of novelty items. There were festive decorations. You know, they become these heroes. And unlike Laika, who was you know, this noble sacrifice. Portraits around Belka and Strelka are very much playful. You know, they're a lot of childish sort of ones.
We're going to run out of time, and I have to ask you about this. The thing that just amazed me is that some of the space dog DNA, at least, makes its way to the White House.
Yeah, so a bit of sort of diplomacy, really, between Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev and Kennedy. Khrushchev gave Kennedy one of the puppies of Strelka, and became one of the sort of menagerie of White House pets at that time. Strelka, in turn, had a litter of puppies, and these were given away to American children. They had to write to the White House why they should have one of these puppies, and these were given away to children across the United States. So they're almost certainly descendants of Strelka, the first orbiting space dog to make it back to Earth, almost certainly in the U.S. today.
What I love is the name that they came up with, these, the Pupniks.
The Pupniks in the White House. And you can imagine this dog turning up. So this little puppy turns up at the White House with a little passport. And the FBI were initially convinced that this was some sort of, there's going to be some sort of tracking device or some sort of bugging device on this dog. So, you know, the first thing I have to do is search this dog and check it's not some sort of mole. And then they, absolutely becomes part of, the first family's collection of pets. They had quite a few pets, although Kennedy himself apparently was allergic to the dogs.
We're almost out of time. What is, and this is sort of straightly, it should become obvious, but the legacy and the importance of the space dogs, they literally paved the way for humans in space.
No, I can't hear you now. Yeah, it went quiet, went silent. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. What are the legacy of the space dogs?
I think every astronaut, every cosmonaut owes their survival in space to the pioneering efforts of these space dogs. If it hadn't been for these dogs, we would not know that we could survive in space.
Wow.
There were all sorts of ideas that, you know, our brains would turn to jelly, our hearts would explode in zero gravity. And the only way to find this out, short of sending someone up, would be to send animals up. So learned so much from these dogs that enabled Yuri Gagarin to fly into space, that enabled the moon landing program, that enables astronauts to now live for a year on the International Space Station. So, you know, I really think the road to the stars is, paved by space dogs.
I love this. Thank you so much. My guest tonight has been Richard Hollingham. He's an award-winning science and space journalist, and we've been talking about his book, Space Dogs, the story of the celebrated canine cosmonauts. Richard, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.